So thank you to Seidel for hosting, and thank you again to Neil for arranging this. My name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm the assistant Rosh Beit Midrash, the assistant head of the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash. We're a study hall here in Toronto. We also have a lot of involvement with the community, with different professionals. And what we're going to talk about here is some of the issues that come up in inheritance and succession planning in Jewish law. Before we start, I'll just note, I put the note and link over here at the top. A more expanded version of this was given by the head of our Beit Midrash, Rabbi Turchiner. It's available at the link here at the top. Listening to the archive qualifies for 1.5 professionalism CPD credits for anyone who's interested in listening and counting that. He's had that approved. So if you want to follow up on these issues and get those credits, that the link is at the top. When I send up a follow-up email, I'll also send out a link to both this lecture and that lecture. To begin the discussion and why this becomes such a sort of complicated issue for modern halachic scholars, for scholars of modern Jewish law, we start here with number one and two. So number one, simply the verses from the Bible that discuss inheritance law according to the Bible. So the verses here in Numbers 27 say, "And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, If a man dies, and you have no son, she shall cause his inheritance to pass unto his daughter. And if he has no daughter, then you'll give the inheritance unto his brothers. And if he have no brothers, you'll give the inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his fathers have no brothers, then you'll give the inheritance unto his kinsman that is next to him in his family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be unto the children of Israel a statute of judgment, as the Lord commanded Moses." And Maimonides, the great codifier of Jewish law, living in Egypt in the 11th century, in source 2, in his book where he records all the positive commandments in the Bible, writes that what we derive from here is that the Torah, or the Bible, commanded us concerning the laws of inheritance. So just to start with that as an introduction, in general, right, Jewish law includes ritual law, right, laws that pertain to holidays, the dietary laws, sacrificial laws. It also includes monetary law. In general, monetary law is pretty flexible within Jewish law, because we have principles that, for the most part, while there are outlying principles in Jewish law and monetary law, since primarily the monetary system is built on agreement between people, so we tend to allow people to, if they want to, as long as they're explicit, not follow the explicit laws in the Bible on many monetary issues. For example, there are laws of when someone gives an object to someone to watch for him. So there's a list of different types of relationships you could create where you borrow it or you rent it out, and a list of things that you would be liable for, the types of accidents you would be liable for and ones that you're not. The Bible sets the starting point for the discussion of liability. But if the parties involved would decide that they wanted to have a different set of liabilities, as long as they were explicit, and when they started the agreement, they set out different parameters, that would be totally legitimate. Because, again, while the Bible has monetary law is more flexible and can be legally changed as long as there's the agreement of the parties. Partial exception to this rule is inheritance, right? Because at first glance, inheritance is a monetary law. So we should say, and we'll see some people really do start going this direction, would say that while the Bible has this this protocol, right, that even without a will, even without an explicit plan for succession, the Bible provides a protocol for how property should be divided. First, it will go to the sons, and if there are no sons, it will go to the daughters. If there are no daughters, it goes to other relatives, and so on. One would say, well, it's monetary law, and as long as the parties involved, meaning the parent who is leaving over his property wants to leave it to somebody else, right? Wants to leave it to one son as opposed to all of his sons, or to, you know, a cousin or a friend instead of his family, he should be allowed to do that. But the assumption in Jewish law is that the laws of inheritance are not purely monetary. They also have a ritual component to them. And because inheritance is viewed in Jewish law as a hybrid between pure monetary law and ritual law, the rabbinic decisors, starting from the earliest sources in the Mishnah and the Talmud, which are the sources in the 2nd and 4th century, all the way through modern decisors, are very hesitant to simply wave their hands and say, the Bible says this is inheritance law, but we want to do it differently. So what we're going to see is this struggle and this attempt to sort of compromise between the original laws, the original biblical laws, with an attempt to integrate the desires of the person passing away and bequeathing his property. So what we're going to do is just sort of outline the different mechanisms that decisors have dealt with to sort of create a comfortable compromise between the original biblical law and getting to something which resembles modern inheritance law without violating the biblical laws. One more introductory note is that, right, the way I presented it now, right, it almost sounds as if, right, there's a biblical law, and then, you know, the rabbis throughout the generations are very good at finding loopholes which basically create the effect of negating the biblical law in practice. Which raises a general question, right, of when, and in different laws you find different perspectives, when in Jewish law we endorse legal loopholes and when we don't. Getting into the details of that question is beyond our scope. There was a recent dissertation done at NYU by Ilana Stein-Hain on the question of legal loopholes in Jewish law. But the basic starting principles, I would say, and we'll see this as we go through, is that rabbinic decisors, right, scholars of Jewish law, are more likely to endorse legal loopholes if they can explain why using those loopholes are still in consonance with the general values of the Bible. And if they can describe and explain why that they have an internal reason to the Bible to circumvent the letter of the law, they're more likely to allow legal loopholes, because then they can say that they're circumventing the law in service of the law. So in inheritance, what we're going to see is that on the one hand, scholars of Jewish law are hesitant to totally ignore the biblical models. But on the other hand, they find other values latent within the biblical system to explain why, in a modern context, we wouldn't follow the letter of the biblical law completely, and we would try to circumvent it. And what we're going to see is that decisors try to come up with different ways of balancing those two goals. Okay. So now let's just see some of these sources inside to paint this picture. So in source 3, we have a passage from the Talmud in Tractate Bava Batra 133b. And the Talmud is the most basic of Jewish legal texts, written about the 4th, 5th century. And it says as follows: one can write away his property to others, leaving his children, but the sages are displeased with him. Right, so already in the Mishnah, which is the Talmud is a commentary on the Mishnah, the Mishnah being the 2nd century legal work. The rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud already recognize that there are ways of circumventing the biblical laws of inheritance. Right? The laws that say that even without a will it goes to your sons, and then if not your sons, your daughters, etc. But the sages don't like it. Right? The sages don't like if you completely circumvent biblical law. And the reason, again, I think, is, as we said, that inheritance law is viewed partially, not entirely, but partially as ritual law as well. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, however, he is remembered for the good if his children are not behaving properly. And he puts an exception. He says, well, if you have, let's say, three sons, right, let's make it simple. So according to biblical law, the firstborn would get double. The second and third would then divide the remaining property. So you would take, let's say he left $1 million, you divide it into fourths. The firstborn would get $500,000, and each of the other two sons would get $250,000. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel thinks that if one of the children was a wicked son, and you're worried of what he's going to do with that money, right? He's going to, right? Your older two sons will take the money and they'll, you know, pay off their mortgage and they'll pay for their children's education and they'll set aside, you know, money for the children's weddings, and your third son will go and squander it on alcohol and drugs and who knows what. So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, then it's good. And what you see already in this first source is a tension, right? You see that the anonymous first voice in the Mishnah thinks that we don't like when you circumvent biblical law regarding inheritance. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel already says, but if there's countervalues, right, there's countervalues within the sort of canon of biblical values, so then we will endorse it. Now, the anonymous rabbis here in the Mishnah don't seem to like this, but we'll see why in a minute. But first, let's see a few more sources that go in this direction. So in 4, and this is from the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is slightly later, written in Israel as opposed to in Babylonia. So there the Talmud says, Rabbi Abba Bar Mamal said, regarding one who writes his property to others, leaving his sons, meaning writing his children out of his will, it is written, and their sins were upon their bones. Again, you see a opposition to completely circumventing biblical law, which dictates that your sons are your primary or exclusive heirs. And in source 5 as well, Shmuel said to Rav Yehuda, sharp one, do not be among those who divert inheritance, even from a bad son to a good son. And now we see the explanation. Why was it that the majority of sages did not think that you should simply write out your bad son, your mischievous child from your inheritance? Because he says, you don't know what sort of child may emerge from him. Right? Because inheritance, the value of inheritance, of passing it to your children, is not just that you'll be able to support your children, but that you'll be able to support your descendants. And a child who is, you know, an alcoholic may have himself a child who can use the money beneficially, take it, go to college, be an upstanding member of society. And therefore, for you to play God and say, well, this child doesn't deserve my money, so I'm going to write him out of my will, is not recognizing that there's a bigger picture. And in source 6, Rabbi Shua Falk, now trying to capture the sentiment here, writing in the 16th century, writes, this is because the Torah's portion of inheritance assigns to the heirs the right to stand in the place of those who bequeath to them in their lot and inheritance. He says the central value that you see is, again, as I mentioned, this ritual component, or, I don't know, ritual component, this component that's beyond the pure will of the one bequeathing his property. The Torah sets out laws which implies rights to the children. Right? There's this value in the Bible that you should leave your property to your children, that they should take your rightful place, that after you pass on, you no longer exercise full control or control at all in your property. And you have to leave your property to the next generation. That is the value of the Torah. And therefore, for you to try to circumvent that, and you to try to manipulate the system so that you write out the children you don't want, or write out your children entirely, that is going to be problematic. Despite that, right? Despite this hesitation on behalf of the early rabbinic scholars of the Mishnah and the Talmud, to endorse full-scale loopholes that will basically write the biblical laws out of practical relevance. Despite that, throughout the generations of halachic decisors, multiple mechanisms have been introduced to allow people to, at least to a certain extent, circumvent the biblical law, which again, is that all things being equal, your property will be left to your sons, not daughters, simply the male children. A double portion to the firstborn, and a single portion to the other sons. when there's no sons, it would go to daughters, and then to a father, and then to uncles, and so forth. Different mechanisms have been introduced to make it that was not practically what happened. And that's what we're going to explore, is what exactly are the mechanisms that rabbinic decisors have used from the time of the Talmud through the modern period to allow people to plan their succession, right? Plan their inheritance, decide who is going to get how much of their property, right? How are we going to, if you want, divide up your property equally among your children and not give the double portion to the firstborn? How are you going to give inheritance to your daughters? How are you perhaps going to leave some of your property to charity, right, to philanthropic causes? How are you going to leave it maybe to a sibling, even when you have children? How do you leave it to a friend? How do you leave it to a school? How do you leave it, etc.? One last point before we jump into those mechanisms is that one of the ways that modern rabbinic scholars have suggested, not totally ignoring the biblical law, is that even when they endorse using the mechanisms that we will see, they suggest leaving a certain portion of your property to be divided according to the unadulterated biblical law. Now, they disagree by how much of that is, how much money you have to leave. But like, if I, you know, at some point when I was in Yeshiva University, some of the teachers were discussing it. You know, many of them were not too stressed by how much, but they suggested, let's say, leave $1,000, right? So if you leave an estate of $1 million, so $999,000 will be left to be divided according to your will. And $1,000, okay, so you have three children, it will be divided according to biblical law for them, so that, at least as a token, you've recognized that, right, you've captured this value that we've seen here, that you're not supposed to be completely in control of what happens after you pass away. You've at least left some of your property symbolically in the hands of God, so to speak, and left it to God's laws. And even if you're going to manipulate the system to fulfill your desires and give the property to the ones that you want, you're still going to at least give a nod, so to speak, to the biblical law. And that's sort of the first compromise that's introduced to try to balance the desire of allowing a parent to give his property to the one that he wants, with maintaining this notion that the Bible values your recognition that after you pass away, you are no longer the boss of your property, and at some level, God has decided what's best for your property, and you should, at some level, take a passive role. Okay. So now, as I said, for the most part, despite everything I've said, the tradition of scholars of Jewish law has been to find ways to allow people to actually write wills, to actually plan their succession, despite the fact that the Bible has its its de facto laws. Right, there have been many mechanisms that have been introduced. So the first thing I want to address, the first mechanism, is not that prevalent amongst rabbinic scholars, but it was in fact endorsed by two of the leading scholars of the 20th century, by Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik, which was simply write a secular will. And there was these two preeminent scholars felt that despite everything we've said, right, if one simply writes a secular will, that will circumvent all problems, and a secular will be recognized by Jewish law. And that's it, right? No more, no fancy mechanisms. A will be enough to completely and totally circumvent the biblical law. Their contention is based on the following. If you look at 7, and this is quoting from the Code of Jewish Law written by Rabbi Yosef Karo in the 16th century, which is the sort of the most prominent codification of Jewish law. He writes as follows: if a healthy person says, record a deed and give this field to X, then while he is alive, they record and give, and it is valid so long as he does not recant before the deed reaches X's hand. However, after his death, they do not record a deed and transfer the field unless he enacted a kinyan with him. So the law is as follows. During one's life, right, one can basically do whatever you want with your property. Posthumously, you can't. So the law is that if you want to give a gift posthumously, or you want to say that give this property to X, so normally if you say give this property to X on my death, it doesn't work. To circumvent that, all you need is something very simple called a kinyan. A kinyan is loosely translated, it's hard to fully translate, a legal acquisition. Right? It is the catch-all phrase for all legal acquisitions in Jewish law. And the basic law that that Rabbi Yosef Karo derives, and this is derived from the Talmud, is that if you want to be able to give a gift posthumously, then what you need to do is in your lifetime decide, I'm going to give this gift, and then do some sort of act of acquisition, and that act of acquisition will act to concretize your commitment to giving that gift, and then that gift will be given upon your demise to whoever it was you wanted. So, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, in Source 8, writes that logically, in my humble opinion, a will like this, meaning a secular will, which certainly would be upheld in accordance with the words of the person who issued it under the law of the land, should not require an act of kinyan. There could be no greater kinyan. He says, if the reason that we say that you're allowed to have a acquisition posthumously is because you did an act of legal acquisition that expressed your legal conviction, and therefore it becomes binding. So he says, well, if you write a secular will, you know that that will be respected by the authorities. You know it's going to be enforced. That means that when you wrote that law, you expressed in as strong terms as you could possibly express your wishes for your property posthumously. And if, in fact, all you need to circumvent biblical law is to say, I have expressed my unequivocal legal conviction that this is what I want to have into my property, then by signing and writing and signing a secular will, you have done that. And therefore, Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik argued that the simplest way to circumvent all of biblical law is simply to write a secular will, let it be executed, and that is all you need. However, despite the fact that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Soloveitchik were two of the leading scholars of Jewish law in the world, and definitely in North America, and right amongst, you know, in discussions normally of Jewish law, if someone says, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said this, or Rabbi Soloveitchik said this, or even more so, both of them said this, that usually ends the discussion. In this case, the opposition by other scholars was so vehement that even within Yeshiva University, which is where Rabbi Soloveitchik was the leading scholar for decades, even there, his position is basically not accepted. And the reason is because the majority of rabbinic decisors believe, as we've noted, inheritance law is more than pure monetary law. It's also ritual. And it takes place between, usually, only Jews, right? Because it's from a Jewish parent to a Jewish child or a Jewish relative. And in general, when we're dealing with inter-Jewish monetary law, especially monetary law that is itself related to ritual law, there is an extreme hesitation on behalf of rabbinic scholars to simply wave your hands and accept secular law over Jewish law. And therefore, despite the fact these two leading decisors felt that you could circumvent the biblical law simply by writing a secular will, that mechanism was for the most part not endorsed, and you will rarely hear people actually using that within circles of people who follow halacha. You will hear it, but it is rare, and especially people who are involved in halacha tend to prefer covering all of our bases. So when there is strong opposition, we tend to find other mechanisms to cover all of our bases. So what other mechanisms have been introduced? So the second mechanism that's been introduced is that the parent should give a gift with a retained life interest. So just to give the legal background for this mechanism, if you look in 9, again, Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Code of Jewish Law, he writes, if one writes his property to his children after his death, the body belongs to the child from the date on the document, and the produce belongs to the father until his death. Therefore, the father cannot sell it, for it is given to the son, and the son cannot sell it, for it is in the father's domain. And there's a principle in Jewish law where you can create sort of a joint ownership, where what you do is you say, I am from this moment bequeathing this property in my lifetime, in its entirety, to my child, or to anybody else, really. I could do this to anybody. But I maintain rights to the... Thank you. I maintain rights to the product, to the fruit of this property during my lifetime. Right? The metaphor for this used in the Talmud is a tree and the fruit. Right? That the father will give the tree to his son, but will keep the fruit for himself in his lifetime. From that moment, neither the father nor the son can sell the property, because from a legal perspective, the son has full rights to the tree itself, and the father has full rights to the produce, so neither of them is the full owner of the property. So this mechanism, this notion that one could split, is one suggestion that people have for how you could essentially, right, plan your succession. Right, what would you do? You would take your property, and instead of saying, I will bequeath it to my children on my demise, I say, I bequeath my house, my business, my stocks to, and we'll get into problems with some of those categories I just raised, to my children from now, but I maintain the right to live in my house until I pass away. So therefore, how have you circumvented inheritance? By transferring it from inheritance to a living gift. And in your life, there are no limitations on who you can give property to. So that's one way that scholars have suggested. If you look at 10, this is an article by Donna Littman and Stephen Reznikoff. They just summarize what exactly this looks like. And they say the transfer of a future interest also requires that the kinyan, again, this acquisition, be accompanied by appropriate language. Thus, a transferor who wants to retain beneficial ownership until just before death could state or include in the deed, this transfer is from now until one moment before I die. By this language, the transferor will retain the right to possession of the property until the moment before death. Or that's another way of doing this. Instead of saying, I retain it until a moment before my death, which basically means that I'm going to do the act of acquisition in my lifetime, but it won't actually affect my life because it'll wait till the moment before I die. By this language, the transferor will retain the right to possession of the property until the moment before death, when that right will vest in the transferee, because at the transferor's death, the property belongs completely to the transferee. The transferor's Torah heirs receive nothing. And again, right, what this would affect would say that you've circumvented the laws of inheritance by transforming it legally, right, at least formally, from inheritance to a living gift. There are some problems with this. And here's a summary in 11 by Rachel Blumenfeld. You're here. Hi. Thank you for your wonderful article. And like I mentioned at the beginning, see, I was worried. You know, whenever you quote somebody and they're here, you know, it's always scary. Neil was nice enough to print, like I said, a few copies of the article by Rachel, if anyone would like. We have a few over here. I'm sure if you want more, Neil, or I can email it to you. So, again, this is very awkward, but quoting Rachel, there are a number of practical and legal drawbacks to this solution, not the least of which is the loss of control by the donor over his or her property, right? The problem is that Jewish law takes this seriously. If, in fact, right, you decide that what you're going to do is you're going to give your house to your child, maintaining only the right to live in it. Well, what happens, let's say, if that parent, right, the parent does this when he's 50, and he can't imagine, right, a time when he's not going to want to live in his house during his life. 35 years later, right, he's walking with a cane and wants to not be in a, you know, his nice three-story house with nice, beautiful stairs going up to it here in Toronto with no ice covering those stairs when it's negative 14 degrees outside. He wants to move to a condo with everybody else, right, where everything is taken care of, and he wants to sell his property to afford the condo with the ever-rising, you know, property prices here in Toronto. He can't do that because he's, right, this is not just a loophole, right? What he's done is he's given his house to his child and only maintained the rights to live in it, but he can't sell it, right? So this has significant drawbacks because, right, he may want to sell that house and he'll be stuck unless his child agrees to sell that house, which he may not, right? The child may say, look, right, property tax or property values go up by 10% a year in Toronto, right? Why should I sell it now and you move to the condo, right? You know, God willing, you'll live another 30 years and this house will be worth 10 times what it is now, right? So I'll get you an aid and you'll stay in the house, right? But, right, and this can create real problems as well. And this is, you know, another practical problem. There would be tax consequences to the transfer if there is an accrued gain realized on the disposition, unless the property is a principal residence, right? Right. This is a real gift, which means that, again, legally, there are tax consequences to that, right? Your property is now going up in value. If the donor does wish to proceed with a transfer of this nature, it is important to document what is to occur if, for example, the donor is unable to continue living in the property, such as in the case that I just illustrated. So this is a mechanism that can be used, but it has a lot of practical drawbacks, as Rachel so nicely summarized here. So moving now to a third suggestion, and this, I think, from my research on the topic and from my time in Yeshiva University, if I remember, it was one of two people who gave the lecture. It was either Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who is the assistant head of the Beit Din of America, which is the largest Jewish court in the United States, or it was Rabbi Yonah Ries, who is the former director of it. So these people who deal with this issue a lot, they both attested to, whoever it was, attested to the fact that this is probably the most common, and historically is also the most common, which is creating artificial debt. So, in Jewish law, we have this concept called artificial debt, where basically, I can declare, right, that, if I want to, that I owe Neil $10,000. I never borrowed $10,000 from Neil. There's no reason for me to owe $10,000 to Neil. But if I take two witnesses and I say, I hereby declare that I owe $10,000 to Neil, right? We write it in a document, we sign it and date it.
I'm your witness.
I'll
say. Great. From that moment, I owe him $10,000, and that is enforceable in a court of Jewish law. So, a mechanism was introduced hundreds of years ago already that wanted to use this to basically create a way of controlling inheritance. There were two models to it. Well, first let's skip to 14 for a moment. I'll just note in 13. While this works in Jewish law, in 13, Donna Littman and Simon Reznikov just note that as a general, American law does not enforce an obligation or deem it legally binding when a person voluntarily undertakes an obligation to another without consideration or consideration substitute. So this will, at least in the States, I'm not sure if this is true in Canada. Is this true in Canada as well?
I think what they're saying when they say consideration substitute, they probably mean that if it's done by under seal, then it would be enforceable.
Would it be? Okay.
Yeah, I think you can do it so that they're...
Okay, so...
That's what they're...
Okay, so, right, so there are ways of doing it. Many of the times when it is done, at least in the States, it's probably not enforceable in a secular court because they only do it in a document given to the Beit Din, given to the Jewish court. The rabbinic scholars debate why we have no problem with creating an artificial debt that's actually not enforceable in secular law, but the assumption is that it's not. So we'll just work with that for now. So this was used in historically in one of two ways. To basically create a mechanism by which a parent could control his inheritance. Specifically, at least historically, the reason they wanted to do this is, as I noted, right, biblical law gives the property to the male children. Right? The daughters only get it if there are no male children. Now, why that's true in the Torah is an interesting question. I think the simplest understanding, if one reads the biblical text, is that the time the Bible is given, the primary property that one is bequeathing is real estate, right? And you have to pick one person to take the real estate, because otherwise it constantly transfers between tribe, right? So what happened was, the assumption was, the male children who inherit the tribe of their father would inherit the property, so it would remain within the tribe of Judah, let's say. The daughters who would marry someone possibly from another tribe, right, or at least from another family, would then be integrated into their house, right, and to their tribe. But if they were to inherit the property as well, right, you would lose all control of tribal inheritance in the land of Israel. Once Jewish law has been struggling, basically since the Middle Ages, or the early Middle Ages, with the fact that we've moved from real estate being the primary issue we're dealing with to one of many. For example, in the time of the in the early medieval period, in the period of what we call the Gaonim, according to Talmudic law, when one borrows money, one can put a lien only on real estate, property, or on houses, but not on chattel, not on movable property, which makes sense in an agricultural society because the primary thing that people own is land. It doesn't move, right? You can't hide it somewhere. So that was what you put a lien on. In the Gaonic period, they realized that most people, right, especially not the wealthy people, did not have that much real estate, right? Maybe they rented from they were serfs for some feudal lord or the equivalent in the early medieval period. What they had was, pillows and blankets and, their horse and sheep and their wagon. So if they're going to go now to the wealthy, the wealthy banker and say, I need a loan, because otherwise I can't put food on my plate, or I can't buy new equipment for my business. And he says, okay, well, what are you going to guarantee it with? And he says, well, I don't have any property. I own horses and sheep. And, they bring it to the rabbi, and the rabbi says, that's very nice, but you can't put a lien on horses and sheep. So then, right, he's stuck. He can't take a loan. So they set up a decree in the Gaonic period that you could put liens on chattel, on movable property. So I assume that once we moved, that part of the impetus towards finding a way for daughters to inherit was, once we moved away from the world of real estate, right, and exclusive real estate, and even within real estate, we moved out of the land of Israel, right, and even within Israel, you're not living within tribal territories, right, there's all the concerns that probably motivated the original biblical law, at least until the Messianic period, when we go back and we get, somehow redivide the land, right? Pragmatically, for Jews, for thousands of years, right? Those concerns don't exist, right? And so I assume that was what really motivated people to find a way of giving an inheritance to daughters. A second point just to note is that even though it's true that in biblical law, daughters didn't inherit, the sons were required to support and provide for the dowry of the daughters, which often could be more money than was actually inherited. Right? The Talmud's description of it is that if push comes to shove and there isn't enough money in the estate, so the daughters will be supported and get their dowry, and the sons will beg. Right? So, right, it wasn't always the case that the primary money left over was going to inheritance. It could be that it was going just to food, and that would go to the daughters. So with those two points, right, you realize that a lot has changed since that period, right? Because now we're talking about people who their property, the real estate they have is not in the land of Israel, it's not tribal, and they have a lot of money that's not real estate to begin with, and daughters, right, are, right, daughters and sons are equally not attached to the land. So, therefore, these mechanisms have come up to give specifically daughters a way of inheriting. So, now coming back to this mechanism of artificial debt, what was created was called the shtar, at different points, chatzi zachar, and now more popular than that is shtar kulo zachar. Now, what that means is a document of half a male, or a document which makes her like a male. Now, why half a male, right? The original versions of this would give a daughter half that a regular male son would get. Now, whether that was because daughters were still not the primary breadwinners, so they were marrying into families who would take care of them, or they were trying to maintain the biblical model at some level, and in the biblical model, the firstborn gets double. The regular son gets half that. So they were trying to maintain some sort of symbolic nod to the fact that the daughters are not the main heir, so they get half of that, just like a regular son gets half the firstborn, whatever it was. The original mechanism was the shtar chatzi zachar. The most common practice, I think, now is what was called the shtar kulo zachar, which is that we use this mechanism to make a daughter equivalent to a son. And the Reb Moshe Itzerlis, the primary Ashkenazi, right, European writer of the 16th century, writes as follows: the practice of shtar chatzi zachar, writing for daughters that they should have a share like the males, writing in the form of an admission that he owes a certain sum to her, and he will not be exempt other than by giving them a share like the males, and so he can give her that which he does not currently own, whether that which is due or that which he currently has. So, right, to explain it outside, what he would do is follows. Now, there's two mechanisms of it. One of them is more complicated than the other, so I'll use the simplest mechanism, which is currently used. But there are two mechanisms, just to know. Simplest mechanism goes like this. The father says, I, from this moment, declare that I owe my daughter $10 million. Now, his property is worth about $500,000. Right? He says, I owe her $10 million. Now, it is collectible upon my death. Now, who's going to have to take care of the loans? His sons, because they are the heirs to his estate. The first thing you do when you inherit money is you pay off the estate's obligations.
Because they inherit the assets plus all the liabilities.
Exactly, right? Because they inherit, right? And this is, I think this is true in secular law, right? This should, with whatever limitations in Jewish law there is, but for the most part, that's the rule, right? You inherit the money, you inherit the liabilities as well. But then the father puts a condition in it, and he says, however, the obligation to my daughter will be waived if my sons give her an equal percentage of the inheritance as they themselves receive. So then at his death, what happens? Right? He has, let's make it easy, right? He has one son, one daughter. So now the son has two options on the father's death. He inherited $500,000. He has two choices. Inherit the full $500,000 and keep it for himself, thereby incurring a liability of $1 million, which is double the amount of the estate, or give his sister $250,000, which is the same that he inherits. He's going to take option two because, right, his option is either becoming $250,000 richer or $500,000 poorer. He's going to take option two. So the simplest version of this is what's called shtar kulo zachar, which where the father says, he picks some exorbitant sum and says, I owe it to my daughter and my sons will have to pay it off unless they agree to treat her like an equal heir as they are, thereby compelling them to do that. The reason this is so, right, such a beloved mechanism is one of the big problems in some of the other mechanisms. You know, for example, the one we saw before is that the one we saw before only works with property that you own when you give the gift. But let's say, you know, he made his will when he's 50, and then when he's 80, he himself, you know, makes it big in the stock market, right? He's not going to be able to give that to his daughter because he didn't sign it over to his daughter. Here, doesn't matter, right? No matter how much property he continues to get until the end of his life, it doesn't matter because he hasn't directly given it to his daughter. He's created an incentive for his son to give it to his daughter. And therefore, it will be a catch-all and will include all property that he will get. So this, I think, is the most commonly used. Two other mechanisms that we'll go through quickly because we're running out of time. And here again, I quote from Rachel, is the possibility of joint tenancy, where the parent and child, or let's say the daughters, who he wants to give inheritance to but don't inherit in biblical law, right, will jointly own the property he wants to give. There are several drawbacks to this, which is why I think it's less common. And here we'll read it again. Transferring and holding assets in joint tenancy with children during lifetime may be a solution to the halachic issue of distributing assets to the daughters on death. However, in Canada, one must proceed cautiously. There may be tax implications to a transfer to joint tenancy, where a true joint tenancy is created, as the parent may be considered to be disposing of one half of the property. And in light of the... Is it Picor? Is that how you pronounce it? Picor and Saylor decisions. If the property is transferred to one of several children with the intention that the child is to distribute the property among several siblings, the property may be considered to fall back into the estate to be divided according to the will. That said, if as discussed above, there had been a proper kinyan, again, a proper acquisition at the time of the transfer into joint tenancy, the child holding the property at the death of the parent should be able to distribute it in accordance with the will without offending the halacha. So this is a potential mechanism, right, where the father could make the daughter a joint owner of the property and then make her responsible for dividing the rest of the property amongst the children, thereby maintaining rights for herself to a certain portion of the property. But there are potential legal setbacks. But halachically, it is another model and there can be ways of making this work legally as well. One more mechanism, and here it's summarized by Rabbi Chaim Jachter, who's a current scholar living in New Jersey, is by creating an inter vivos trust. And he summarizes it as follows. A new suggestion may provide a halakhically viable solution to the Arusha issues in a manner that is consistent with common secular legal and estate planning for many people. This involves establishing a revocable living trust, a contractual arrangement between a person as the grantor forming the trust, preferably that person and another person as co-trustees managing the trust, and he and his family members as beneficiaries to receive the economic benefits of the trust. This approach to a living trust is fundamentally different from the more simplistic approach of most living trusts, in which one would be the sole guarantor, trustee, and beneficiary until death. The latter approach is less likely to be respected as a valid entity under halakha. If the former kind of trust can be regarded as a legal entity, a third party by halakha, and the subsequent transfers of one's asset to such a trust characterized as lifetime gifts, this commonly used secular planning technique may afford a new method of complying with the Torah requirements concerning Yerusha, of inheritance. So there is this suggestion to create an inter vivos trust. The problem, halachically, is that modern Jewish law, has a lot of ambivalence of how we treat legal fictions, estates and corporations and things like that. So it's not entirely clear that this would actually work halakhically, because this legal entity is somewhat fictitious. So it's a potential solution, but again, I think for the because of the complications in this one and some of the legal drawbacks of the joint tenancy and the limitations in terms of what property can be included in the first mechanism, right? The gift with retained life interest. I think the most common mechanism used is what we call the shtar kulo zachar, by creating the artificial debt, thereby giving incentive to the sons to simply treat the daughters as equal heirs in the property. Just a few. A few small issues. Just on the motivation to find a way to basically bequeath your property in such a way that resembles modern civil law and the common accepted practice, rather than simply following the biblical precedent. So in addition to the fact that many people simply want their daughters to inherit, right, or they want to leave some property to, you know, their spouse, or they want to leave it to a brother or a sister or somebody else, there are also legal reasons why a biblical, a purely biblical inheritance may not be recognized by secular law, further motivating people to find a halachic mechanism by which they can create something that resembles a civil will. I mean, here this is a summary of the issue from Chuck Wagner, Charles Wagner, but whatever. We call him Chuck when he comes to my lecture on Sunday morning. So he summarizes as follows. A seminal case in this area is Stone versus Stone. In 1995, multimillionaire Harry Stone hatched a plan to ensure that his wife of 24 years, Sarah Stone, would get very little upon his death. In particular, Harry wanted to make sure that his commercial wealth would go to his children from a prior marriage. The problem for Harry, of course, was the Family Law Act, which lets the surviving spouse seek equalization against the estate in the same way that a spouse might on a divorce. Harry tried to thwart his wife's rights under the Family Law Act by transferring his assets to his children before he died. The result was that when Harry passed away on July 21st, 1995, there was virtually nothing left in his estate. Essentially, Harry was preventing his wife from exercising her claim under the Family Law Act for an equalization of net family property. In this case, Ontario Court of Appeal recognized the possibility of using the Fraudulent Conveyance Act to set aside transfers made with intent to defeat, hinder, delay, or defraud creditors or others of their just and lawful actions, suits, debts, accounts, damages, penalties, or forfeitures. In Stone versus Stone, the court held that as a spouse who held rights under the Family Law Act at the time of the fraudulent conveyances, i.e., the right to seek equalization, Sarah was a creditor or other within the meaning of the Fraudulent Conveyance Act. Accordingly, Harry's transfer to his kids were declared void, and Sarah received an equalization payment of $851,937. So, at least in Canadian law, at least Ontario law, if one were to write his daughters completely out of the estate, that wouldn't stand up in civil court. So one of the motivations to finding a way to give some of the inheritance to the daughter is that otherwise she can just demand it through secular means. And Rachel again adds another point here in 18, that it is unlikely for observant Jews in Western societies to want to execute wills that are strictly in keeping with the biblical laws of inheritance. Not only would such a will be viewed as unfair and likely to cause discord in a family, in many jurisdictions, secular laws may be applied to overturn such distributions. Just one or two last points here. We've spoken mostly about the mechanisms that we use in Jewish law to, despite the biblical model, find a way of giving money to one's daughters or other relatives that one might want to leave it to. The other sort of type of person or body one might leave it to is charity. So that is also something that is endorsed. And in Source 21, the Talmud says that while someone's alive, I'll just say it outside, we encourage people, unless possibly they're extremely wealthy, to limit their philanthropy to 1/5 of their property, because we're worried that people might become impoverished if they give away too much of their property and end up being a burden on society, which is why some limit it to people who aren't themselves phenomenally wealthy. But posthumously, right, we are totally fine because their life is over. They're not becoming poor. They're dead. And in 20, the Talmud just notes that the Talmud actually doesn't think there's any motivation to leave anything to your children. But the Talmud thinks, right, Rish Lakish, when Rish Lakish died, he left behind a measure of saffron, which is, you know, barely any money at all, and he implied to himself, and they left their strength to others. Right? He bemoaned the fact that he left any money to his heirs, because the Talmudic perspective is really that you have no obligation to leave money to your heirs. Right? You can live it up, right, until the day you die. Right? Live rich, die broke. That's totally fine according to the Talmud. It's just that if you choose to leave money to your children, then we have to figure out the best way of doing it. But again, there is no obligation to ensure that you've left money over to your heirs. So just to quickly summarize, again, a fuller version, which deals with many of the pragmatic things, a little less with the legal theory. I've put the link at the beginning, and again, that is available for 1.5 professionalism CPD credits by Rabbi Churchiner. The link is at the top. We've noted that Jewish law views inheritance as a combination of ritual and monetary law, leading scholars to try to find some way of maintaining the spirit of biblical law while creating ways in which daughters and other relatives can inherit. We noted that some thought you could simply write a civil law and that was enough. That was opposed by many rabbinic scholars. We noted several other mechanisms that are used: giving a gift with retained life interest, creating either a joint tenancy or an inter vivos trust, or the most common, creating an artificial debt. And we noted that despite all of this, the Talmud does not think that you have to leave over money. It's just that if you do, there is a way of giving it over to your children. And the last point, that there is some value to leaving some money to charity, without, again, getting into the mechanisms of how one does that. And again, as I noted at the beginning, there are those scholars who believe that because we want to respect both the will of the parent leaving over his money, but also sort of recognize the biblical value of recognizing that once you pass on, you are not really in control of your estate. Many scholars suggest that even after you use all these mechanisms, leaving some money, let's say $1,000 over, as a nod in the fact, right, as a nod to the fact that once you pass away, you are no longer in control, and let that money fall as it will, according to halacha, as a symbolic act of recognizing that inheritance is not purely monetary, but also has this ritual component, is meant to remind you that, right, you are not in full control, even that of which you think you are in control of. Thank you. Questions or comments, corrections? It's not aimed at anyone in particular. And like I said, there's also the article here by Rachel, if anyone wants to read it. I don't know how many copies you made. There's enough for what is it, 7, 8 copies?
Ten.
Ten copies.
Thank you.